Hello and welcome, everyone. I am Jake Wurzak, and this is Masters of Moments. This podcast features conversations with the top entrepreneurs and business leaders around hospitality, real estate, investing, and company building. Thank you so much for joining me and enjoy the show. You've heard it on the podcast so many times, and I'm going to say it again. Relationships are everything in real estate. At Dove Hill Capital Management, one of the most interesting things about our track record is that the majority of the deals have come to us off market or lightly marketed. So we had this innovative idea a few years ago, and that was to launch the Deal Rewards Program at Dove Hill Capital Management. If you want to learn more, you can go to www.dovehillcos.com. Again, that's www.dovehillcos.com. You click on the little deal rewards icon and you can sign up. And if you have a deal that's off market that somehow came to you, maybe you're working on a deal, you're trying to put it together, bring it to us because we can help you get that deal done through our deal rewards program. We offer industry-leading incentives. We'll allow you to co-invest in the deal. We could come up with another interesting structure to allow you to do the deal with us. The Deal Rewards Program is incredibly unique and will give you an opportunity to do a deal with Dove Hill, either in a completely passive position or maybe you're taking a more active role. Either way, please check out the Deal Rewards Program at www.dovehillcos.com. Appreciate it. And this is how we've been getting our flow. The team at Wurzak Hotel Group is just firing on all cylinders right now. So I am very, very excited and proud to announce that we now have a third-party management program where we are managing hotels for other owners. We used to just manage hotels for ourselves, and now we've made some tremendous forward investments in people, our team, technology, accounting, finance, and most importantly, culture. And we are prepared to bring that out to everyone. Our team is experienced in managing independent hotels, branded hotels. We have focused heavily on boutique, lifestyle, and experiential hotels. And we're ready to manage a hotel for you. So if you are interested, if you want to learn more about what we do and how we can help your hotel, please visit wurzakhotels.com. I'm excited for this one because Cyrus is at a new point in his career. He's doing something new. And he had a very big career that he left. And that was one of the top hospitality brokers in the country. So I think we're going to blow the lid kind of off a lot of the brokerage scene, a lot of the styles. Maybe we'll get into some gossip. But then I really also want to talk about what you're doing, what you see as the opportunities, because it's really unique. We were talking like the other day where someone that's on the brokerage side actually goes into the principal side of investing.
Yeah, well, I'm actually doing this podcast because I need a discount on the masterclass because I don't know how to buy hotels. I've been a broker for 15 years. I actually don't know how to do it. So that's the impetus for this decision.
Well, I have the masterclass because I haven't been buying hotels in the past couple of years. So we need to generate some extra income to, you know, keep the Wurzak and Dove Hill empire afloat.
Perfect.
Let's talk about your experience as a broker. For those that don't know, your dad's in hospitality as well. But how did you even like get into hospitality? Why did you want to get into hospitality?
I wanted to get into advertising. Because I thought I was really clever and I could write Bud Light commercials back in like 2006 when I graduated from college in one of the best job markets that we've had. And I was completely unemployable because of my college career. And so I did what any responsible, somewhat adult would do. And I went to my dad and asked him for a job. So that's how I started my career in hospitality. I had literally no plans to get into the hotel world. So I started my career at Canyon Equity 20 years ago, really early on, as Amman Giri was just coming out of the ground when the company was in its infancy. And then, so that's 2006, 2007, market's great, things are fun, GFC hits, it's not so fun anymore to try to build and sell luxury residences. Wasn't a huge market for that. So I went back to grad school. But at that point, you know, I'd had a little bit of hospitality experience under my belt. So I sort of knew that was the path I was going to take, and it was just a function of trying to figure out where I was going to go next. And so 2011, I was considering where I might end up, and I was put in touch with Dan Peek, who at the time had just started, maybe 2 or 3 years prior to that, had started the hotel team at HFF. And so, you know, I got a chance to talk to him, sort of understood what the role was. I think there were like half a dozen people on the hotel team at the time. And so it seemed like an interesting opportunity. So I accepted the job. And then I kind of said, okay, where is the job? Because I was under the impression it was either going to be in San Francisco or New York. Ends up it was in Miami. So I spent 4 years in Miami. What I thought was going to be a 2-year brokerage career, I figured I'd get some reps and move on. And then I ended up transitioning from Miami up to DC to start the hotel practice for HFF there. And then about 5 years ago, myself and most of the former HFF hotel team got a chance to join Hodges Ward Elliott. So I spent 5 years in DC with HWE. So right around 15 years. So long way of answering, that's how I got into it. I didn't really anticipate it, but yeah, typically when you have, as I'm sure you can appreciate, family in the business, it sort of finds its way to you, whether you like it or not.
It always does. And we're attracted to it despite the obvious risks and challenges and pain because it's so fun. I want you to talk about the differences you saw between Miami, investors, players, opportunities, and what you were doing in DC, because you kind of saw both at very interesting times of the cycle, which, you know, lasted for a very long time.
Yeah. So Miami was fascinating. You know, this is, so I got there in 2011. I was there until 2014, and it was sort of Miami hitting its initial heyday from a real estate standpoint. So I got down there, and I think the commentary was that it would take like 5 years to absorb all of the condo inventory, because again, post GFC, and it was absorbed in 18 months. And we all rented condos, and everybody's landlord was some random Venezuelan. It was uncanny. Like everywhere, that was the case constantly. And it was a lot of flight to safety at the time out of South America. And so a lot of that got gobbled up. And then from a hotel perspective, you know, it was like really early on when hotels outside of New York were starting to hit a million a key every now and then. And so you saw a lot of kind of a combination of ego buys, but also some real institutional capital coming in. Honestly, it was a lot of fun being down there at the time. Like we sold the Raleigh to Tommy Hilfiger. You know, that's probably the most interesting deal I worked on just because of the buyer. But just the way, you know, look, the demand dynamics were totally different. It was a market that was virtually devoid of corporate at the time. It was obviously group and leisure, and the travel trends were very much dictated by what was going on in South America. And Miami was just becoming, you know, not as though it was still a spring break destination shortly before that, but it was really still kind of coming into its own from a high-end luxury leisure standpoint. So, you know, I kind of cut my teeth in brokerage down there. It's a really unique place to be in the transaction market. There's like three layers of brokers, and you're never sure if you're talking to the actual capital. And there's like, you know, you're talking to some broker who's representing another broker who's representing a high net worth person in Argentina, in total cluster, but a lot of fun. And like a genius, I left in 2014 to go to Washington, D.C., which is, you know, it is what it is. But the district is very different, and I'm still here today. I mean, look, the major difference is D.C.'s boring and less dynamic, but you know, in theory, up until COVID, high floor, low ceiling, and Miami is the exact opposite. I hate politics. I have no interest in any of them, but I had to learn everything about congressional patterns and when they were in session and what happens when the Republicans in office and the Democrats in office and alignment and Congress versus the White House. And as it turns out, you can't actually identify any of the impact because there's too much noise, but it didn't stop us from putting together research reports that said things were going to get better. So, yeah, I mean, look, you almost couldn't pick more polar opposite markets. I think, you know, Miami's probably more interesting. DC, like 80% of the hotels perform exactly the same maybe more than that. It's probably the easiest market to underwrite in America. So yeah, maybe a little bit less interesting. We weren't selling anything to Tommy Hilfiger, but it's an institutional market and there are a lot of interesting things going on in Northern Virginia. And so it was, you know, good 9-ish year run in DC. And so, yeah, I got the barbell effect, no pun intended.
In Miami, at that time, I think a lot of focus was on the beach and beachfront properties. Were you starting to see inklings of opportunities in other areas or pockets? And like, how did you think about it at that time? And obviously hindsight's 2020, but in terms of Miami's growth, how did you think about the other areas coming up in relation to the beach and whether they might be successful or not?
Yeah. So around that time is when Fort Lauderdale was really starting to take off. And, you know, I think we're roughly the same age. So if you go back to the mid 90s, if you were watching MTV at the same time I was, you were watching Pauly Shore hang out on MTV Spring Break. And so like, that's what I had in my head for Fort Lauderdale. And then so, right, I mean, that was, you know, great times, but it's not great for institutional capital. And so, you know, the beach was already its own thing. And there was already institutional capital coming in. And, you know, it was a place where, you know, everybody kind of wanted to be. Our view was that Fort Lauderdale was sort of the next, not even the next frontier. It was already halfway there, but it would just be sort of a half step behind Miami Beach. And that is kind of what happened. And frankly, we had the same view on Naples. And you could probably argue that Naples has taken off more than Fort Lauderdale has.
Yep. And West Palm.
Yeah. And so I think I think the comment we always used to make was like, they're not building any more beach. And so if it was on the beach, then you were probably in pretty good shape. Even the Keys, right? Like that was just as I joined HFF, we sold Chica to Northwood. And I don't remember what the per key was, but at the time it felt absurd. And it wasn't at all. It was a great buy. And then the Keys, we always used to do these reports that said if the Keys were big enough to report in Star, right, it would be the highest RevPAR market in the country, which wasn't a lie. It's just kind of skewed. So I think, you know, all those markets really started to take off. So our view was, yeah, you want to be in Miami, but if you can't be in Miami, but you still want to be on the beach, you get great opportunities in, yeah, West Palm and Fort Lauderdale and Naples and even some of the further north markets that probably in the last 5 to 7 years have started to take off. So yeah, you can't go wrong being on the beach for the most part.
One of the things that I've found really interesting about hospitality brokerage is the amount of work that brokers actually do relative to other asset classes. We've invested in some industrial real estate recently, and literally, like, I'm not trying to like disparage anyone else, but the amount of effort and work you guys put into making books and doing diligence and figuring out business plans and pulling back all the layers is quite phenomenal. Why is that?
Well, I don't do any of that. The team did that.
You figured out how to say it all. I mean, you had to tell people the story.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's just more moving parts, right? So I think what I found out early on in my career in brokerage and really spending time meeting with people and going on tours is that from a business plan standpoint, everybody has a different idea of how to execute something, depending on the asset. Some are pretty fair way, but depending on who you're talking to, who you're meeting with, whether they're an operator or capital, there are some very unique views on how to address an investment. And so I think probably that sort of suggested to me that maybe I should actually get smarter on this stuff. Because, the way somebody once described the life process of a deal to me was that if a deal is A to Z, broker starts at A and gets off somewhere on D. So you just like, as a function of that, you just can't get that granular in the weeds. And so I think to differentiate yourself a little bit, and to at least come across as competent, because a lot of these folks were in operations and asset management. Like I wasn't, but you want to at least pretend that you know what you're talking about. So, you know, I think if you're doing your job right, you are getting a little bit more granular in the P&L. But a lot of the information is already there. Like if I'm selling a hotel for somebody, I'm going to ask them for the business plan, and I'm just going to read the business plan. And now I know, I didn't necessarily come up with any of it. I just sort of regurgitate a lot of what the operators have put together. And so, yeah, I mean, look, there are more moving parts than in an industrial building or an office building. You kind of, as a function of being in the market, you should know what's going on in the market. But honestly, like, I think, you know, most 300 room full service hotels are the same if it's in suburban somewhere, urban somewhere. So once you sort of get the, basics, you know what you're looking for. So I guess long way of saying, like, there probably is more to know in the hotel world. But once you do a few of them, you sort of get the cadence for what you need to be looking for and how to at least sound like you know what you're talking about. It's 90% of our job or my former job is just sounding like we know what we're talking about.
The brokers we have the best relationships with are the ones that at least seem the most credible, meaning if they're telling us to get to a number that's actually the number we have to get to, and there is a bidder close by, how much of that stuff is actually reality versus, you know, you guys just pumping something that's not that competitive?
Yeah. Well, in almost every occasion, if you're the second highest bidder, there's a 50-50 chance that you're the highest bidder. Because if you actually are the second highest bidder, then I'm going to tell you you're the second highest bidder. And if you're the highest bidder, then I'm just going to tell you the second highest bidder. So there's always somebody $1 million higher than you. Look, there are, like, that's only half a joke, but like there are groups that you know are such good buyers that as soon as they put pen to paper, like, your money good, right? And so that carries so much weight. And you can count on almost one hand who those groups are, where I can say I've done multiple transactions with them and, like, you know, as smooth as possible, no retrades. But look, I mean, at the end of the day, like, we're a fiduciary for our client. And so it's kind of dependent on the relationship you have with whoever is on the other end of the phone. And if you do it long enough, you also sort of understand how to read the buyer pool, right? And so in the same way that if you deal with me a dozen times, you probably start to, you know, see through some of the bullshit. That, am I allowed to swear on this podcast? Is that allowed?
Yeah, you can curse all you want. Let's go.
Perfect. So you can kind of, you figure out, okay, he said this a few times and he, you know, wasn't being forthright. So you can probably get your arms around it. You know, typically if I have a few bids that are probably coming in sometime in the next couple of weeks, I probably don't have any bids. There's like stuff like that. But then, you know, there are folks who you've transacted with before, you have a very good relationship with. Again, you know, they're a very competent counterparty, and I'm probably going to be more transparent with them. And so, yeah, it's hard as I'm starting to learn on the other side, but I just feel like sort of a superpower where I'm hearing some of my former competitors talk, like, yeah, I used to say that. So I think I know what's actually happening. And then you also have to consider where you are in the cycle, right? The last couple of years, like, if I told you I had 10 bidders plus, I was probably lying, because there's a good chance that, or like, if I had 7 bids, then, you know, 6 of them were verbal. So, yeah, like, and then when things start to accelerate and all of a sudden everybody's falling all over each other, then, you know, but again, as a buyer of real estate, you kind of know where you are in the cycle. And so if somebody starts telling you, oh yeah, this, you know, whatever deal in some sort of uninspired market at a 6 cap has 30 tours and 20 bids, I might not be telling the whole truth. So, yeah, you can't trust us, I guess.
What's the best negotiation story you've been a part of that you can remember from your time as a broker, when maybe you started sweating or you started laughing?
Okay. I'm not going to say what or who, because I shouldn't. So it's like 2015-ish, I think, 2014, 2015, we're working on a deal that was very well received. Got a bunch of bids. And we made the decision. There were two groups at the same number, and one of them we felt like had just done more work for whatever reason, felt like we should go with that group. And so I called them to award them the deal. I got the voicemail and I said, hey, give me a call back. Want to catch up on this deal. I guess I didn't say anything other than that. Well, before they called me back, we had a conversation internally and we're like, well, wait a minute. Shouldn't this deal be going to the other group for XYZ reasons? Because they're probably a better buyer. They were going to do something, and I'm not going to say what, because that might give it away, that probably made it a faster transaction. And so we called them. We said, hey, under these circumstances, would you guys do the deal? And they said, yes, we would. And I said, okay, it's your deal. And then the other guys called me back. Once they got my voicemail, I said, I have bad news. It's not your deal. So it literally, like, if they had just picked up the phone and taken my call, like, not that they were ignoring me, but if they were there to take my call, they would have been awarded the deal and they would own it today. So I think that's probably the most, wow, if they just picked up the phone, it's a $100-some-odd million transaction that goes to somebody else. So that was pretty interesting.
What's the biggest difference you've noticed, whether it's the buy side or sell side, between like the Blackstones of the world and owner operator groups?
Well, the biggest difference is that if the Blackstones of the world show up, they're going to win the deal, right? I mean, just if you know the money is there, then they're going to win, and they also are more, they have control over the decision, right? And so when it comes time for the disposition, that's when you're going to get the next bite at the apple for that asset, right? Or whatever asset it is. So there's the whole balance of trade concept where you're selling to somebody. On the owner operator side, and I guess in some respect now I'm kind of an owner operator, but so I guess I have to be somewhat gentle with how I say this. But it's hard to, it's this delicate balance in the brokerage community of, you have to make sure that the owner operator, who is then a second layer of brokerage, right? Because they're out sourcing capital and selling the deal on your behalf, on their behalf. You got to make sure that they're saying what you want them to say. Because there are a number of groups out there who will chill the market. And so there's a, that you when it comes to the true capital and the private equity, like they're going to bid what they're going to bid. And they're going to do what they're going to do. And it's not really going to impact the rest of the market because they're not talking to anybody else. Like the owner operator community is having those conversations. They're talking to capital. They're talking to some of the private equity. And so they have a very meaningful impact on a marketing process by way of, look, if we go to, I'll say HHM because I like them a lot. If we talk to HHM, I could have a very candid conversation with those guys beforehand and say, look, this is what we're targeting. And we think you're a good option for this deal. And if you're supportive of that valuation, that business plan, then, let us know. We'll connect you with everybody. But if not, we know that they're not going to make a half a dozen calls and tell everybody it's worth 15%, 20% less. So yeah, again, when you do it long enough, you sort of know who is an ally in your marketing process and who can be a challenge. And so that, look, from the broker's perspective, that's probably the biggest difference is, the owner operator community is sort of a second layer of the brokerage outreach, and the private equity, the funds are just, they're going to do what they do and they're going to give you a number and you're going to say yes or no. And that's kind of that.
When you've been in the business for a while, maybe 10 years or more, you really start to see these patterns and trends, and you also see other people make mistakes. You make your own mistakes. And one of the things I'm seeing right now is there's a lot of commodity type hotels. There's a lot of older branded hotels, maybe built in the 80s or the 90s. And the conversation about value add, I think, is really hard to actually execute, and not as easy or as sexy as it sounds, particularly for some of these older assets. What are you seeing now on the investment side? I know you're not looking at that, but also what were you seeing then, and kind of how did that shape your overall opinion of where you want to invest?
Yeah. So as Dan Peek put it, for a very long time, as an industry, we are not overbuilt, we are under demolished. And that's, you know, it's commentary about a lot of this older full service suburban product, right? And look, there's some suburban markets that are perfectly fine to invest in, and it doesn't make commercial sense to try and build a new full service hotel, but it can still be a good suburban corporate market, right? A little out of those in the DC area. And so there is potentially a second life or second renovation, third renovation, fourth renovation cycle for some of these assets. But yeah, I mean, some of this stuff is, you know, it's hard to underwrite the amount of capital that would take just to be defensive. And then you have to consider, well, what is it I can even do to create value, right? I mean, a lot of that, you know, say for certain markets where you've got, you know, really dynamic corporate and growing corporate base. Like, again, you know, think about Northern Virginia, like National Landing, where Amazon's come in. There's like a real story there. And so I think you can justify spending capital and actually calling it value add. There are a number of markets out there where all you're doing is sort of keeping up with the Joneses. I don't think they're making that material a difference. And so I think from our perspective, it was hard. You know, it's got to figure out how you're going to pitch a deal that maybe you don't personally have a ton of conviction in, but your job is to have conviction in it. And what we're doing now is so far afield from that type of investment thesis that I didn't really have to ever consider whether or not it was something that I was going to do. But I mean, look, there's this whole concept of like, of different costs of capital and how certain capital gets driven out of those marquee markets. And then you go to the next one, and the next one, and the next one. And so there are investors that just sort of as a function of, you know, the size of their fund or their, you know, return hurdles or whatever it is, like kind of have to go to those markets because it's hard to justify the return thresholds that you need, you know, in a major urban market, right? So yeah, it's tricky. There is a home for a lot of that stuff and some of it works, but man, you got to get the timing right. I think that's my biggest takeaway.
Like, where is the home for that?
Oh, like on like who the next buyer is?
Yeah. I mean, like what's the, you know, like do you bring it to, yeah, Choice or I don't know, one of these like different brands? I mean, it's hard to imagine actually like that you can just always make money. I mean, I don't know that story just plays out forever.
Yeah. I mean, look, if it's in a submarket where you can't justify building new products, then in theory, it can always make some money because there's, you know, how could you justify building something new? But yeah, there is a point where these hotels are going to reach functional obsolescence. And at that point, I mean, the question that we would always get is, okay, if we buy this and we renovate it, who are we going to sell it to? And the real answer was, probably not even have to worry about that. Like, I'm probably not even be long enough or around long enough to have to sell this a second time. And then sometimes I was. But the real answer is there's always new capital, right? In every, you know, 5-year microcycle, there's a new fund, there's a new institutional family office. There's, I mean, 2011, the private REIT concept was really not a thing in the way that it became in like, you know, 2016, 2017, 2018. You know, for a lot of that product, hey, does it yield? Is it a rational basis? Great. So I think the less snarky real answer is that you sort of bank on the fact that there's always going to be some sort of capital that needs to be deployed. And it typically has a way of finding those types of opportunities. I mean, look, if you go back to like 2011, 2012, 2013, coming out of GFC, the amount of 1980s full service busted hotel product that sold for like 50 to 70,000 a key was shocking. But that was that was a very real thesis. And I don't know that it is today, but you know, back then it was. So again, there's always a different investment thesis and a different type of capital that comes along. And you know, you just sort of hope you get bailed out at the end.
So I want to talk now about what you're doing and what kind of inspired that. During your experience at HWE and HFF, your dad and Canyon were kind of working on some interesting projects, one of which is Aman Giri. And you saw this from start to finish. What were you seeing in that experience that led you to create your thesis now and want to spend your time in a very, very niche market?
Yeah. So I think initially, you know, earlier on in my career at HFF, I probably wasn't thinking as much about it because just, you know, I was sort of in the throes of getting deals done in Miami and DC. And I just, that was sort of where my career was at. And then kind of towards the tail end of my HFF career and definitely at HWE, we really had a focus on luxury and ultra luxury. And a lot of that was a credit to Mark Elliott, who had some very, very, very unique ways of, I think, taking the ultra luxury space and the luxury space, which was always a, I guess you call it, you know, it was always thought of as an ego buy, right? And then there were some publicly traded REITs that did a good job of owning it, but how you'd actually put a, like a data-driven argument behind it, that wasn't really done. And, you know, credit to him, he had some very interesting ways of conveying, you know, okay, long-term RevPAR CAGR for the first one I actually, he did was, at least for when I was at HW, it was the long-term RevPAR CAGR for hotels over $500 RevPAR. And then, okay, so that's your, there's your performance. How do you sort of tie that to demand, right? And so he had the team pull together the growth in the ultra high net worth community. And as it turns out, you know, it sort of tracks, kind of like when you look at hotel RevPAR as compared to GDP, right? So if for, you know, the first time that I saw it, so first and foremost, I realized how bad I was at my job when I got to HWE, because you had people like Mark making these comments and pulling together these arguments. And I was like, I definitely wasn't doing that for the last 10 years. So that was my first takeaway. But the second takeaway was, so now there's a really thoughtful way to argue why this is a very sound investment thesis. And at the same time, as you pointed out, you know, Canyon and my father and the group there was doing something really special that I don't think the world had quite figured out yet. It wasn't out there that Amangiri was performing the way it was performing, and the kind of hockey stick move that Amangani made, and you know, even to a lesser extent, you know, Le Malazan out in France. And so, you know, kind of happening in lockstep, I was starting to spend more time in the ultra luxury space, and they were having the success. And then sort of in the last couple of years, when I wasn't doing anything because there was nothing to do in the brokerage world, I started thinking a little bit more about what the next step in my career was, knowing that I probably wasn't going to be a career broker, although I got dangerously close. So it felt like there was this really interesting opportunity set in the ultra luxury space, and really nobody on an institutional or quasi-institutional basis trying to aggregate them. So it felt like the right time to make that move. And kind of at the same time, my father, you know, retired, and then he unretired and, you know, started a new company. We kind of said, what, you know, can we replicate what they did for those, you know, 15 years, but do it on a more programmatic basis, do it in not a traditional fund structure, but something, but a fund structure nonetheless, and see if we can make this sort of, see if we can replicate this and make it a little bit more sustainable. And so, look, I think the timing is interesting. I think when you look at the, you know, you look at the main demand drivers for that type of product, they feel pretty recession-proof, right? The biggest concentration of wealth in the world is in the, you know, North America, and specifically the United States. And interestingly, the US and largely the Americas is kind of in its infancy from an ultra luxury standpoint relative to, you know, Asia and the Middle East and Europe. So yeah, I mean, it's an exciting time. See if we manage to pull it off, but that was kind of the thought process. And at least for me, in kind of moving on from the brokerage world and getting into, as you point out, a very niche space in the lodging segment.
What does ultra luxury mean to you?
It's a good question. So to me, it's probably dictated by specific brands. And so, you know, we think, you know, Aman certainly Six Senses, Auberge, Cheval Blanc, right? Any of those kind of smaller sub 100-ish key type assets that are maybe a little bit more leisure focused and cater to a guest that, again, is really not price sensitive. You know, it's hotels that can offer a level of service and value where you can extract that type of rate positioning. There's not a perfect explanation for what it is. We sort of look at, you know, from a metric standpoint, can we be at $750 of RevPAR or more? And the stuff that we're going to build meaningfully more than that, because as it turns out, it's really expensive to build this stuff. So yeah, I mean, like, it can be, I think it means a lot of different things to a lot of people. I think a lot of folks, you know, base it on brand. I think a lot of candidly don't really know the difference between luxury and ultra luxury. Hopefully we can do a half decent job of, you know, creating that delineation. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of how I view it. So it, again, when we're looking at stuff that's that type of performance, it's a pretty limited opportunity set. And so we're going to have to create some of it. But, you know, man, if you sort of take the performance of some of these assets and roll them all up and compare them to what, like, the metrics on a publicly traded REIT would look like, it's all creative. You know, it all seems to pencil and make sense. If you can hit those performance thresholds and really get it to flow. And so, yeah, there's a lot that goes into it. I understand why nobody else has really done it, but they're cool. Worst case scenario, you own a really cool hotel.
Yeah. And your investors have a great place to go.
Yeah, exactly.
How important is a brand to you in that strategy?
Very. So look, I think you can have independent ultra luxury assets, but the reality is they are their own brand, right? And so, like, Blackberry Farm, it's independent, but it's its own brand. Like, that asset, you could probably create a brand around, right? Little Palm Island is its own brand, right? It's a, you know, I don't even know, you might do it a disservice if you, what's the asset out in Big Post Ranch, right? Post Ranch. So those have sort of taken on a life of their own. And so you do have those situations, and there are others, but I think for us and what we're going to do, we are really big believers in brands, you know, in the same way that, you know, we think about from a luxury perspective in a non-hotel space, there is just a certain cachet in owning certain types of products, right? And so we believe that staying at an Aman is akin to owning a Ferrari, right? And there's that pull, that kind of gravitational pull that these brands have, where if you build it, they will come. You gotta build them right. You gotta put them in the right places. But overwhelmingly, I mean, look, yeah, we are big believers in brand from a distribution standpoint. We're big believers in it from a branded residential standpoint. And so we've got, I think, very well, the team, the legacy team at Canyon has spectacular relationships with these brands. And frankly, when you look at the ultra luxury brand space today, I mean, there is clearly a lot of institutional conviction, because Six Senses was acquired by IHG and Auberge was recapped by MSD, and, you know, PIF bought into Aman, and there's been so much capital invested into these brands that you go back 20 years, the brand meant something, but it didn't have the firepower behind it that they do today. And so that's another reason why it's a compelling time, because they're incented to grow. And, you know, they all of a sudden have the corporate infrastructure to really support the ramp and the performance. Whereas, you know, again, one of the reasons that I think the asset management folks at Canyon were so spectacular is that they really help build some of those. You know, you look at Aman, for instance, in the United States, it was Aman Ghani and Aman Giri. And I think they themselves did they had a very significant role in establishing that brand in the Americas at a time when the corporate infrastructure wasn't a modicum of what it is today. So, yeah.
As you think about expanding and launching the platform, what insights have you gained from how successful Canyon was to actually make these things profitable? A lot of times people go into ultra luxury with no hospitality background. Some make money, some don't. But the ones that Canyon were involved with all seem to have tremendous profitability.
Yeah. So I think, but my biggest takeaway, and my old self would really like to hear my new self say this, I don't know that you can pay too much mind to per key. Look, from a development standpoint, like, you can't skimp. You know, if you're basically going to, you're delivering a product and you're telling your guest that, hey, well, you're gonna pay us $2,500 a night, and then you're gonna pay us another, you know, $1,000 a day in adventures and food and whatever. And so you better deliver a product from a physical standpoint and a service quality standpoint that is reflective of that rate, right? And so, you know, these folks are willing to spend just about any amount of money, as we talked about this before, as long as there's a value proposition, right? As long as they feel like they're getting value for the number, they're okay spending it. And so I think my biggest takeaway is, you know, if you have conviction in the asset and conviction in the business plan and the pro forma, don't get too wrapped up in what it is per key. Obviously, you don't want to be irresponsible with how you spend, and you're always finding more unique ways to deliver things efficiently. Like, later today, I'm talking to a 3D printing company, because why not? Maybe that's going to be a unique way to deliver some of these assets someday. But so you always want to be responsible with how you spend the money, but you also can't sit there and arbitrarily say, well, this can't cost more than $1 million a key just because. Like, that's a really good way to make a bad decision and deliver a bad product. So I think initially that's my first takeaway. I think second, kind of mentioned before, that traveler is really resilient. And so when you look at the ebbs and flows of the ultra luxury space, depending on how you define it, through COVID, through GFC, through whatever market shock, it snaps back pretty quick. I mean, it's not to say that it's completely immune, but those travelers are just less impacted by gyrations in the market. If you can afford to stay $4,000 a night resorts, it probably doesn't really matter what happened in the stock market the day before or the year before. You're probably going to be fine. And so I think kind of once you sort of get your arms around, okay, it's sort of one demand segment for the entire resort segment, but it's a pretty resilient one, a pretty strong one. So if you're going to hang your hat on something, that's a good one to hang your hat on.
How do you think about the opportunity from a development standpoint, or a buying something, renovating it, taking something that's there, making it special in the context of launching your platform?
Yeah. So look, I think part of it, like, being able to develop one of these things, and I'm not a development guy. It's part of the reasons I'm part of this team now, is because I don't actually know how to do it. But being able to deliver, you know, your own project and your own vision. Like, I remember I was like 22, but I was with Canyon when Amangiri was in its, I think before it even, yeah, way before it broke ground. And, you know, there is a lot of vision and a lot of risk that goes into doing that, but obviously it paid off. And so there is an element of, like, you're not just creating, it's not just an investment, sort of putting your, and I mean, with respect to Amangiri, that team put their stamp on the world of hospitality because they had conviction to deliver it the way they wanted to deliver it. And so, yeah, I mean, look, that obviously there's more risk, but you can really deliver what you want to deliver. And so I think we'll absolutely, because we have people on the team that know how to do it, and there's virtually nobody else, there are very few folks out there that can, you sort of, it's almost a proprietary expertise that Canyon has. And so you'd be irresponsible not to build a couple. I think as far as buying and repositioning, you know, it's interesting, like, some of these assets, Amangani is a great example. It's one that, you know, it's one that Canyon owned for a long time. You, it's timeless. I mean, it's the way that resort was built and how they did it. And there are a number of assets out there similar where you're repositioning it in that you're spending money to bring it up to a current standard, but you're never going to do like a cyclical refresh. You're never going to change. You're not going to meaningfully change the design package or the FF&E package, I don't think. And so, yeah, I think it's more a function of, it's not so much like finding the right value add opportunity and repositioning it. I think it's more like finding a great property that maybe it needs a little TLC, maybe more specifically, it needs some asset management help. I think there's probably more asset management upside in the ultra luxury space than anything. I think that's kind of how we're thinking about it, is we have great chops from a development standpoint, so we'll do some of those. And we have unbelievable asset management in the ultra luxury space. And so kind of, you know, those are going to be two of our main thrusts. And the other thing I'd point out is, you know, people get really scared when the per key gets high. And that typically has a negative impact on, you know, the number of buyers and what pricing looks like, et cetera. And so, you know, one thing I learned in brokerage is that, you know, competition beats pricing. And so you can say something's worth X all you want, but unless there are a bunch of people trying to buy it, it's not. And so we sort of like the idea that at least for a period of time, we're not competing with a huge host of folks. And so I think there's kind of, you know, those are sort of the three buckets, I guess, that we're looking at. Like there's some, you know, asset management repositionings. I think there are just some fundamentally mispriced assets, and there are some really special sites in locations that are underserved from an ultra luxury standpoint.
Which of those do you think hits sooner based on just the current landscape and what your pipeline is today?
Well, we could do as many development deals as we wanted. Like there's... Yep. There are 1,000 resort development deals floating,
and they all look like Amangiri.
You know what? A lot of them look like Amangiri. That's like, I spoke to the team about that before. I think you just, imitation is the something form of flattery, purest form of flattery, something like that.
Highest form of flattery.
Highest form of flattery. Thank you. Yeah. I mean, look, there's a lot that looks like that, but I think it's cool because it means that what was a very architecturally forward development obviously resonated. So I think that's great. But yeah, look, the development opportunity set is as far as the eye can see. And so it's really, particularly now that we are going to be a fund structure, we do have to identify those quickly. You know, we imminently are going to do something else in the Canyon country. And so those, I think, were sort of teeing up first. And then, you know, a lot of this product isn't marketed in a way that we would have, you know, marketed traditional commodity assets. And so a lot of it's incumbent on us to go unearth them, right? Find opportunities to recapitalize something where somebody wants a capital event, but still wants to own it. Maybe we can, you know, assist with some asset management and create some upside. I think those opportunities are out there today, but there's no gun to anybody's head. It's just, you know, can you find the right properties and align with the right partners? People love to talk about distress. You know, I haven't seen it yet, but allegedly it's coming. But yeah, look, again, I think there will be opportunities where there are assets that have slightly challenged capital stacks. And I think where we don't view that opportunity as like, you know, all right, we can go buy some notes and yes, we can go do REO and all that stuff. There's a lot of capital raised for that, and we'll get blown out of the water and there'll be 25 bids. And that's not really where we're going to pick our spot. I think the opportunity on those types of assets is most of that product is fundamentally sound. It's a good physical product, good location. You just bought it at the wrong time or you refinanced at the wrong time. And that's not like a misstep in the business plan, right? That's just that timing got you. And so on some of those assets, I think we view it as an opportunity to say, okay, we probably have a similar vision from a timing standpoint as a lot of these owners. We have a long-term duration. We can add some value through asset management. Maybe we can help recut the capital stack and keep that owner in. Because like, you know, it's a small world, right? The hospitality space. And I would just assume that we have the reputation of being a friendly party. And look, you know, you find an asset and you own something great, put in your portfolio, you've got a good partner for the future. It feels like it could be a win-win. And again, also, if something is marked distress, and I know this from brokerage days, it's just going to be an absolute feeding frenzy to the extent that you're no longer going to get discounted pricing. So,
how did you structure and set up your fund to go take advantage of the opportunity?
Yeah, so it was interesting because I have never worked at a private equity, and nor has the rest of the team. And so first I had to go chat GPT a lot and ask a lot of questions about how to structure a fund. Yeah, I guess I should have just listened to your podcast.
You could.
Maybe I could have learned a lot faster taking the masterclass. So we did a lot of that. I'm only half kidding. And then I had, look, what's great is I've got, you know, 15 years of being in this business where a lot of my very close friends in the business who are now friends, I can pick up the phone and just say, hey man, I have no idea how this works. Can you explain it to me like I'm a 10-year-old? And then when I don't understand it, I can ask them to explain it to me like I'm a 5-year-old. And then eventually like I figure it out. So the conclusion we came to is we know it needs to be a long-term vehicle. And so we've structured it such that we have, you know, we're viewing everything as a 10-year hold, and we have some flexibility to go beyond that. It's obviously dependent on who our partner is on a deal-by-deal basis, but we'll align with groups. We are aligning with groups who have a similar view of the world. So I think first and foremost, it's kind of long-term hold. Second, we kind of view the world as multiple-based investments. You know, there is a reason why this type of product doesn't fall into most closed-end vehicles, because they're typically 5 to 7 years. And like, I'm less concerned about per key, but it is, I mean, you do have to figure out a way to get around it on exit. And I think the best way to get around it on exit is to give yourself more time, because, you know, when everything started trading for 2 million a key, we started telling everybody, you know, 2 million a key is the new 1 million a key. And we actually we have stats on it somewhere, how many $2 million per key trades there were over the past 2 years versus the prior 10. And not to call the world lemmings, but like at a certain point, you just need that marker out there where when somebody meaningful does it, everybody else goes, oh, okay, I can do that. Nobody will tell me I'm an idiot. So, you know, that multiple based analysis kind of takes the cuffs off a little bit as far as the misalignment of incentive to exit too early, where if we were more, you know, IRR based, return based, we, you know, it would behoove us to be out faster. And that's not what's best for this product type, in our opinion. And so we try to be very intentional with how we structure the fund so that we can accommodate what we think is the appropriate hold period while still having our incentives aligned with, you know, our investors in our GP fund, as well as, you know, the folks who will ultimately be our LP. I could not have given you that answer 3 to 4 months ago because I had no idea how to do it. So I've just kind of crash coursed it. So we'll find out if any of this is right. Might be a disaster, but I guess we'll find out soon enough.
So are you just willing to kind of let your promote ride for the 10 years because that's how long a lot of these things take and you're patient to do that? Or did you kind of build in different structures to compensate you for doing all the work along the way?
Yeah, I mean, our intent will be, and this is why it's so important to align with the right groups, but our intent would be to, you know, structure some sort of a promote crystallization event so that, again, we're incented to keep it as long as we need to while also being compensated for the value that we create. The team historically has done a really, really great job of being conservative from a leverage approach when necessary, but then taking a lot of chips off the table when the property's ramped to a point where it can support it. And so, not to get too much in the weeds, but I mean, you know, Amangiri effectively has no basis and they still own it. So I think that is one approach that's been very effective. And again, as this has become, again, not necessarily institutional, but a little bit more accepted, there is a wider swath of lenders that will look at that type of product. So I think in those two instances, and then obviously, you know, for the ground up stuff, we'll have residences and that always helps, you know, juice returns. We've thought about it. Look, there's a reason that nobody's really done this because it's very hard to align the traditional fund structure with a very long-term hold. Some have done it really well, but they, you know, that has been a ton of it. So yeah, on paper, it works. We'll see what happens in practice.
Is your plan to kind of aggregate it so there's some diversification, or is each asset pretty much going to stand on its own?
So each asset will stand on its own, but the idea is that we will create some diverse. I mean, we like the idea of geographic diversification because we just think there are a lot of different markets in the States that, in the Americas broadly, that that can support this type of performance, and we want exposure to all of it. I think there's an interesting argument to me that you can create some real, you can create a seasonally complementary portfolio by having exposure to the West Coast and the Southwest and the Mountain West and, you know, Florida and you know, Mid-Atlantic, all sorts of markets. So they do all have to stand alone, and they will, but I think we do like the idea of having that complementary seasonality exposure to different markets. You know, some of these assets are a destination unto themselves. Some of them are largely driven by their access to very high-end demand in, you know, New York, DC, LA, pick your market. And so different things drive them. But that's kind of how we're thinking about it. And look, if we can create a portfolio, if we can aggregate a portfolio and find some sort of programmatic exit, portfolio exit, sub-portfolio exit, that's, you know, we're sort of viewing it as like, let's do the work for some heavyweight in 10 years, and then they can just take it off our hands. And we've kind of created a thesis for them. And it's a thesis that I think a lot of people believe in, but it's hard to, it's, from a capital standpoint, it's not always efficient to pull these deals together. Obviously, from a development standpoint, it's difficult. And, you know, just there are a lot of things about them that you look at and go, huh, how much per key? Like, how much NOI per key? It just, so I think if you can make it a little bit more bite-sized from a portfolio standpoint, there's an interesting exit that, you know, if it's not there, they should pencil on an individual basis. But if you really can roll these up and find a, you know, as we always like to talk about in the brokerage world, the portfolio cap rate compression. I don't know if that's actually a thing. We talk about it a lot, but we'll find out, I guess, in 10 years.
It's hard to aggregate a lot of good things at once. And I think there's a premium to be placed on that. So it probably is a very real thing. I mean, if you look at like Belmond in Europe, that's an amazing example of an ultra luxury collection. Those to me seem kind of based around cities, and like the experience is a mix of the location, meaning the little town that it's in, and also what the hotel has to offer. In the United States, is the opportunity more these remote places where people basically aren't leaving the kind of area or the confines of the resort? Or is there just as big an opportunity in like a cutesy town where people can go out and explore the town?
Yeah, I think it's kind of all of the above, right? I mean, if you have an unbelievable destination, geographic location, right? Like I'm on Giri's Inn, you can create something really special as a function of your surroundings. And that sort of dictates the architecture and the experience, right? You know, as far as their, you know, cutesy little town or something like that, it would be in a little Washington, right? In, you know, here in Virginia, which has, you know, an incredible 3-star restaurant and a very small, at least from a performance standpoint, ultra luxury resort in a really cool little town. I think the next, certainly in the US and honestly in other parts of the world, the next frontier for ultra luxury seems to be urban. It's probably not what we're going to do, because everything about that is terrifying. And there are groups with better costs of capital, much bigger than us, that probably are better served doing that. But, you know, you think about the Amand of York and what they're doing in Miami and Beverly Hills, you know, the tent poles for these brands where it's accretive just to the broader brand portfolio, right? And so, and then, you know, and then with that, the other thing that a lot of these groups are rolling out is the club concept, because for a lot of these resorts, the people that stay there, they like the idea of obviously it being exclusive. And so how do you get even more exclusive than staying at a 40-room, 4,000 a night resort? you sell memberships that those people can't get into. You know, so I think from a look from an urban standpoint, like, it's going to be a big part of it, and it works. You know, they've done a good job of rolling that out in certain brands and certain locations. So, you know, I think urban, both with respect to just having it in very dynamic locations, helps the brand more broadly. It probably opens it up to a different traveler as well, and broadens out the demand profile, right? It's not just transient leisure and high end social. It's a little bit of very high end corporate. But I do think it's a tough labor model. That's why it was so hard to bring it to the States in the first place, is the labor model is so different in the US than it is in, you know, Asia and other places. So, you know, I think certainly where we'll continue to look in these leisure destinations and really special pieces of land. But I do think you're going to continue to see growth in urban markets.
The ones that are making money, how are they making money? Because I think a lot can charge and generate a lot of revenue. Only few actually flow that to the bottom line. What's kind of been the secret to success there that you've seen, whether it's through Canyon or through others that you've been involved with?
Yeah, it's all rate. I mean, it's like, not to oversimplify it, but you know, the best margin that you're going to get is your room margin, right? And so, again, something Mark Elliott did very well was kind of put together this analysis of, you know, assets that didn't make money, they didn't make money, they didn't make money. And then at a certain rate threshold, RevPAR threshold, all of a sudden one day they started making money because you create that operating leverage, right? I mean, like, it's kind of as simple as that. And you obviously have to do a lot. There has to be a lot of specialization and offerings to command that rate. But I mean, in some respect, that's what separates an ultra luxury brand from a luxury brand. It's this sort of unrelenting push to exceed, you know, to almost like, don't even talk about RPI, right? Like, it's not even like, what are we indexing against?
There is no comp set.
There's no comp set. I mean, you look at the comp sets that are put together for some of these assets. It's like, you know, they just completely made it up. Like, you're cherry picking stuff from like the East Coast and the West Coast and Hawaii. It doesn't actually make any sense. It's because you've created your own demand, and that, you know, was that traveler considering going to Amangiri versus Post Ranch? Maybe. But the reality is, if they were going to Canyon Country, that's where they're going. And if they were going to, you know, if they're going to Smoky Mountains, they're going to Blackberry, right? And so it really is, I mean, there is always going to be a labor model that is higher at those assets. It just has to be, because you do have to deliver that service. But it can't be irresponsible, A. And again, the team at Canyon is really good about understanding what the appropriate staffing levels look like at those assets so that you can be efficient but also deliver the experience. But more than that, it's like, you just have to charge really high rate. You have to create something or deliver something that gets very high rate, because at the end of the day, the margin on food and beverage is fine if you create something great and there are all these adventure experiences that you can do and maybe your spa is screaming. But if you're, you know, running a $3,000 rate and it's a 70% expense margin, is probably going to flow pretty well. That's where most of your money is going to come from. So I think it's kind of not rocket science when you just look at the P&Ls. The ones that make money is the ones that don't. It's who, you know, if you can get to a certain rate threshold, that's when it starts to really flow. I don't know. I don't know how to do that, by the way. That's like, I don't know how to make that happen, but I just know on paper, that's like what it has to be.
Do the operators know how to make it happen? Or is this like a very, very intense asset management situation?
It's both. So I think there are operators that totally get it. You know, look, if you like, I think there are a lot of brands that have conviction that their travelers will just pay a certain rate if the value proposition exists. And so some of them definitely get it. But it is very intensive asset management. And I think, you know, I won't burn anybody or any assets, but like, we look at some of the stuff and you're like, huh, that's a lot of people working at that hotel, and they're paying the brand. Like, it's that kind of, what is it that you say you do here? Like, it just, So like you can't skimp on staffing. And I think some of the brands get it, but there's always going to be that slight misalignment of, you know, they're paid on revenue and you make your money on net operating income. And, you know, having a, again, what I kind of referenced, that sort of proprietary expertise from the development standpoint at Canyon, maybe even more so from an asset management standpoint, because there just aren't that many folks who have asset managed Aman and Auberge and Four Seasons and all of these different brands. And yeah, I mean, it's, you gotta really roll your sleeves up. It's not, you're not just babysitting. I mean, there's real, you have to have a both the operator's hat and the investor's hat on to really make sure that they're doing the right thing. They're doing right by you as an owner.
You obviously want to make sure your first couple of deals are great, particularly when you're starting a company. Like thinking about it, the deals that you passed on that you were kind of excited about, or maybe you've gotten close on, maybe it's just one. What was really the primary reason why you passed or why the deal didn't happen?
Well, I mean, look, the honest answer is we're probably so early on in this that I can't say I have a long list of things we passed on. But I guess what I would tell you is there are some things we've looked at on a preliminary basis where we just kind of said, look, we can't. It's almost like we understand why you think it's worth this. I don't even think it's entirely fair to say something's overpriced. Like there's, you know, these are really great assets. And so there's always potentially a buyer out there that wants a special piece of real estate in a special location. But like we have a very, we're underwriting the stuff, right? I mean, we are investing in it. We're doing it so that we make money in the long run. And so there, I think there are certain assets where, like as a broker, I would have said, yeah, you know, this stuff, notwithstanding everything that's happened in the capital markets, like could that trade at a 3 or a 4 cap? Sure. Might be worth that much, right? So somebody might be willing to pay it. And I don't think it's reasonable to say somebody's overpaid for something if they're comfortable with what they paid for it. From our perspective, though, we are underwriting it to make money. We have return hurdles we have to hit. We're going to be we're fiduciaries, blah, 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 blah. So I think there's some stuff we just passed on because we can't quite make it pencil the way we need to. And then look, I think there's, from a development standpoint, like it's a high bar because you're, no matter what you do, you're going to spend a lot of money. You're going to spend a lot of money building these things. And so you better make damn sure that the location's right. There's not a better location in that. It might be a great market, or you know, maybe not market, but you know, if you look at Canyon Country, for instance, like you obviously would love to be there. You better make sure you pick the right site. And so you don't ever want to be, you're not building these to play to the existing market. You're overshooting it. And so you can't create something that's, you know, just it has to be the best location and the best asset for this to work. And so I think some things that we passed on, we just kind of said, hey, it looks a great site. You could absolutely make money on it. You just can't make money on it with what we're doing. And so I think those are probably the two themes. You know, they're just some stuff that won't pencil for us that'll pencil for somebody else. And there are some deals that work for certain types of positionings and just not what we're trying to do.
As I think about like the opportunity for you, one of your biggest competitive advantages is bringing kind of this asset management weight and experience with you and potentially getting into an existing deal that needs to be, you know, slightly renovated, enhanced, and maybe provide some liquidity to the original founder or investor versus an outright sale. That seems like a real solid path to getting some interesting stuff done.
Totally agree. I mean, look, I am an irrationally confident individual. And in my time in brokerage, like all you really bring to the table is, you know, your Rolodex and who you know, and, you know, the ungoogleable information that you have in your head. Now I can go have a meeting with people and like the amount of firepower that we have with this group is, it makes you feel really confident that you can kind of like I'm really used to overpromising, obviously, but now it feels like when I overpromise, we can actually deliver on it because we have a really spectacular team. And so totally agree. Like, you know, going into a meeting and pointing to a track record that is largely unmatched in the ultra luxury space and having colleagues alongside a lot of those folks who, you know, I was kind of learning from when I was in my early 20s, the depth of my knowledge, a lot of this stuff is sort of in that capital markets and transactional space, and having folks who were operators and asset managers and developers and sort of have run the gamut. It's a nice position to be in.
Did you have a runner-up strategy that you were toying with, like almost like a white space? If you weren't going to focus on ultra luxury, you were going to do this. What was that? What's the opportunity? Do you see one other than what you're doing?
I mean, like if you're asking me like what I think would be a good, reality is.
I'm saying
is,
like, was there a runner-up to what you wanted to do that for whatever reason you didn't do it, but there was something that was like, that could be interesting.
Now, what I realized is, in every other product type in the hospitality space, there are a lot of people, many of them are my friends, who are just better than me at it. They know it better than I do. Their value add is so much more than mine. And so I just kind of looked at the world and I was like, well, I do sort of know ultra luxury. I can speak to it and I understand at least a high level how it works. And if I try to go, first of all, I can't go raise a fund to do, select service acquisition, because there's like 100 other people that institutional investors prefer to invest with.
Raised all the money. There's nothing.
Noble raised all the money. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, so, you can't do any deals because Dustin Fisher's out buying all of them. And so like the select service space is it's a bit jammed, and then Host buys all the cool hotels now. So you can't do that. So, jokes aside, you kind of got to do what you know. I also know that, I was never going to be cut out to be, in a true private equity environment, which probably wasn't for me. And so if this didn't work, if this doesn't work at the end of the day, I'm just going to go back to being a broker. I mean, I think that's always going to be out there. So I don't, I'll go back to, selling full service hotels in somewhere CBD. And, I guess I can just keep the lights on doing that. But I think this is going to work.
It's going to work. One of the things I've learned when I was first starting out, maybe you felt the same way, is I kind of thought that there was like some genius behind the curtain. And there was always someone that maybe knew something or knew a better way to do it than I knew how to do it, or that was just magically better. And being around people long enough, you realize that there is no special silver bullet behind the corner or behind the curtain. It's just hard work and luck and determination and timing. So you're going to do it.
And there's conviction.
No one else that's smarter or more special than you. It's just a matter of your opportunity.
I think there are probably plenty of people who are smarter than more special than me, but a lot of them are my friends. And so I can call them and ask them for advice. But Relationships are everything. I remember, I think it was Dan Peek told me like really early on in my career, it was kind of, you just build the relationships with your contemporaries, because at a certain point they're going to be, they're going to be decision makers, but they're also going to be your friends. And so like we're in a really, really killer fantasy football league, and it's like 14 teams deep. And I look down the roster, I'm like, man, these people are actually very relevant in the industry now. And they're people that we were having, I was having dinners with, in 2011, 12, 13, and nothing's really changed. You're like, somebody let these people make decisions. That's really the only difference. And so it's like, it really is. It's like, that is the most important part of the business, obviously from a broker standpoint, but just in general. And I'm like, look, just, I think that the people that are really, really good in this business, at least from what I've seen over the last 15 years, there are groups that just have conviction in a thesis and they just go do it, and they don't get bogged down in the last dollar. And, they already know that they're right. And so, you always make the argument before you buy something, you're either right or you're wrong. Like it's usually not a 20, it's usually a 40 or it's a 5. So you just, you have to pick your spot and you have to believe that you're right and you got to go buy it. And I think in my experience, the people that have done the best, and frankly, the ones that have been best to work with, are the ones that just kind of go, you know, we spent a bunch of time coming up with this thesis. This is what we're going to do. We're going to go do it. And we know we're going to be right. And so, yeah, there are some of those folks out there that have done a very good job of, so I will say, like, yes, you do this long enough, you realize that there are some people where you go, huh, how'd you become so successful? But there are also other people where you sort of get it and you're like, okay, this person is smart, but they like believe in what they're doing and they're just going to go do it. And most importantly, they're going to do it irrespective of whether or not the market is behind them, right? I mean, there are a lot of very, very smart groups who just said, yeah, we're going to go do this. And everybody else said, well, that seems stupid. And as it turns out, it wasn't at all. You look at everybody that bought in the keys in like, you know, the early 2010s. I mean, there were a lot of people just going, yep, we're going to spend a whole lot per key on this stuff. And a lot of them came out looking really, really smart. So, you know, good on them.
I asked all the guests on the podcast the same closing question. And that's, what's your favorite hotel?
Favorite hotel? I kind of have to say Amangiri. So I'm going to say within the context of Canyon, it's Amangiri. But if you have to, if I have to take, pick a one, like a 1B.
Yeah, give me one off of the Canyon portfolio.
So Aman Zoe is spectacular. That's in Greece. That's an unbelievable asset. The Oberoi and Udaipur might be, you know what it is? I know what it is. It's the Sheraton and Reston.
It's the best. That hotel is,
it's Sheraton Reston. Awesome. It's the best hotel that I've ever, and I haven't even seen the renovation.
Talk about a value add conversion. This was a hotel that Cyrus sold us, and it's one of these hotels that you just buy it so cheap and you think, you know, how can we go wrong? And we bought the hotel and the thing was printing money, and it needed a massive renovation. So we completely just gutted the hotel and executed this renovation. But right in the middle of that whole renovation, this thing called COVID happened and just obliterated our timing, our IRR, our opportunity. It's still a great asset. It's number one on TripAdvisor right now in Reston.
Yeah, but, that's out of like three hotels.
I was hoping to give it back to you to sell next year, and I'm going to have to give it to someone else now.
Sadly, I can no longer be held responsible for that transaction. But hey, you know, we got it done. Reston's a great market.
It's a great market. Let's just say we had a holdback for suspicious material in the walls, and it wasn't enough by like, you know, two or three times. So if you're buying a hotel built in the 70s, make sure that you're fully aware of what those risks might be.
You know, Jake, instead of saying that, you could just say you retraded me. It's okay. I forgive you. It's been long enough.
It didn't feel like you, though. It felt like, I remember I was in like the Bahamas or something, and I was on vacation, and I got on the phone with, the seller was JBG, and they're like a really, I mean, I think we had a good relationship with them, but they are a very, you know, polished, button-up firm. And I just remember like that retrade call was very, it's like I was like retrading my dad or something. Like it was, the guy was so intense on the other side of the call. He was like a former general, it felt like, of like something. You know, being in DC, it was like, oof, man, but we got through it.
I love those guys. Those guys and those types are my favorite, because when you ask for a retrade, they just say no. It's like, as a broker, there's nothing more satisfying than when you bring a retrade to your seller and they just go, oh, okay, that's interesting. No, we're not gonna do that. Because at least I don't have to do the whole song and dance like, okay, well, we go back at a million, well, it's half a million. It's so much easier when it's like, yeah, okay, we understand, but we're just not gonna do that.
Yeah, you know what's another group like that? Is Westbrook. Westbrook is super hardcore too. I remember we were on a lawyer call with them going through the PSA, and I brought something up and the lead deal guy from Westbrook, you know, just a long pause after I brought this thing up. And then he just says, moving on, next point. That was it. And I'm like, so is that a yes or no? You just said moving on. I was like, you know, okay.
You know what? It's a
good style. I mean, I like it.
Hey, look, it's people would be surprised how effective the strategy of responding to a retrade with no is. Like, it just, there's like an expectation in the transaction world that there's just going to be a retrade. Like, you're sort of baking it in every time. So I think when the answer is no, the buyer just kind of goes like, wait, what? Like, that's surely that's not what they mean. That's not what's supposed to happen. It's super satisfying for the broker. So if any seller out there wants to make the broker happy, just let them go back and say definitively no, unless there's no backup. There's always a backup, but if there's actually not a backup, then you probably just need to play ball. It's still fun to say.
Yeah, people don't use the word no enough. Sean Hare from Trinity told me a great story about using the word no. And everyone is so used to like the wimp response, which is like no, but, and then like a whole five paragraph thing after that. But when you just say no and kind of mic drop, it's very powerful.
Totally. The last 15 years, I haven't been able to do that. I'm really looking forward to being able to say no to things that I don't want to do. I'm just so glad to say yes to everything.
Well, if you're on the buy side, there's a lot of opportunities to do that now. So you're going to do it, man.
I can't wait.
Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, everyone. It's Jake here. Thanks again for joining me on this conversation. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Lastly, don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Jay Wurzak. I'll see you in the next episode.
Jake Wurzak is the founder and CEO of Dove Hill Capital Management. All opinions expressed by Jake and his guests are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Dove Hill Capital Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not reflect or represent real estate, financial, or investment advice.